This is Dominic Preziosi, editor of Commonweal. New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham is one of the most perceptive and insightful young critics working today. Besides his regular theater column, he has also written essays on basketball, the visual arts, New York City public schools, and religion. He also co-hosts the New Yorker's weekly podcast, Critics at Large. His debut novel, entitled Great Expectations and based on Cunningham's time working for the Obama presidential campaign in 2008, was recently published by Hogarth Books. On this episode, Cunningham speaks with Commonweal literary critic Tony Domestico, both about the art and practice of criticism and how the novel can incorporate criticism as a way of life. Their conversation's coming right up on the Commonweal podcast. Hi, Tony. It's good to see you here today.
Good to be here, Dominic.
So actually offline, Tony, we were talking a little bit about Vincent Cunningham's book, and I think you actually had some high praise for it.
Yeah, it's a terrific piece of fiction and really a piece of criticism as well. So the novel follows a young man named David who finds himself working on the presidential election campaign of someone who's only coyly referred to as the senator from Illinois. And it's a wonderful novel filled with incredible writing about politics and rhetoric, beauty and grace, fatherhood and race that is clearly inspired by Vincent's own experience working for the Obama campaign. And I had high expectations, great expectations, even given how wonderful a critic he is, and the novel exceeded them.
Mm. Well, I'm really looking forward to hearing your conversation. I'm sure our audience is as well. So thanks, Tony.
Thanks for having me, Dominic. Welcome, Vincent Cunningham, to the Commonweal podcast.
Thank you, Tony. It's so great to be with you again.
Yeah, me too. And I was hoping that we could start today by talking first about your life as a critic and journalist at The New Yorker. And I was wondering if you could take us back to some of your first acts of criticism. So moments when you were younger, when you experienced the thrill of criticism, maybe what it felt like to be a critic, even if you didn't yet have the language to describe what you were doing.
Yeah, well, I could talk about this through the lens of the two deepest of my childhood artistic or maybe sensual experiences, one being music and the other being sermonic oratory. So I just have a memory. I don't know which of my parents' apartments it was in Chicago, but I believe it was this apartment that was on Holes Avenue and on the South Shore of Chicago, of laying on the ground and someone playing music through a stereo. I think it was on a cassette tape. Mm. And for some reason, because I used to go to, my father was a church musician and my mom was always a choir member and singer, and we had a very musical household. I would always hear my dad playing music in the background, getting ready for mass. But I remember once laying on the floor, listening to a cassette tape and finally understanding, like having an intellectual epiphany, like maybe I was 5 or 6, I don't know, about harmony. It's, oh, wow. I had always heard, oh, voices, and there's something beneath it, or there's this like ambient feeling that I can't understand why this note sounds like more than it is. And suddenly I could hear all three strands of the chord. And mm-hmm. Say, oh, this person's singing like that, this like that. Just being able to break something into its component pieces and understanding that what I liked about music was a kind of simultaneity, right? That mm-hmm. different things are happening at the same time. I grew up in many different sort of faith environments. My parents were Baptists, and then my dad was a church musician who played in many different environments, but including a Catholic church. So we moved to Chicago, and he was the music director of the Catholic church I went to. But then later on in life, my mother and I in New York, were in the Pentecostal church, the church that I, you know, the latter half of my childhood into my early adulthood. And Pentecostal churches are much more sermonically focused than Catholic churches. And I started to hear like, oh yeah, this guy's about to talk for 45 minutes or an hour or more. I don't have a handle on how long this is going to be. And I came to love that form and think of it as just a kind of aesthetic feast, the long half-sung sermon. And I used to always, there's like partially critical, part editorial thing where it's, that was a good line. The line after that should have been X. I would have said this. Just sitting there, not really fisking it for theology, as I would later do, but just fisking it for sound, assonance. Yeah. What would have sounded good to come after that? little rhymes that didn't culminate and things like this. I remember sitting down and just taking notes in my head.
I'm wondering what to make of that, how your religious upbringing has shaped the critic you are and in the way that you specifically kind of engage with and reflect upon sensuousness and sensuous experience.
The great sensuous experience of my growing up and still in my life is the Bible, and is specifically for me the King James Bible.
Yeah.
And reading all that sort of scriptural analysis asks us to do in terms of reading, let's say, an Old Testament text and learning to read the signs of its bells chiming later in the New Testament, or to do the opposite, right? To read a moment in the Gospels as the fulfillment of a promise that came before it, right? Or to do the thing that we do when we read any passages. A good preacher is going to tell you about the historical underpinning of a passage, its common readings, offer a new reading based in a sort of either sort of word by word analysis or historical analysis, or the way that we read as critics. Flannery O'Connor, one of her favorite books, learning about her, she was one of my first favorites for obvious reasons, perhaps. And she really would often talk about this book called Christ and Apollo by William Lynch, by the priest William F. Lynch, right?
Great book.
Yeah. The Dimensions of the Literary Imagination, I think, is the subtitle. And talking about the different ways, the sort of analogical, the anagogical, all the different ways that we read scriptural text as ways that we also create not only meaning, but symbol structures in literature, and especially fiction, has been deeply influential on me. And so that way of reading, that close fisking, that textual analysis that we do with the Bible has been, I think, foremost in my mind as I go about my work as a critic, for sure.
Yeah. Practically, how did you get from being that kid listening to speaking back to them to being a professional critic? Like, when was there a moment at which you kind of decided, this, I've done this on Sundays, now I want to do this professionally?
No, really, those experiences made me want to create art of some kind. That when I was younger, I sang, I ended up singing backgrounds in bands and doing all kinds of different things like that. Wrote poems. I did all kinds of that environment, that way of growing up made me want to live surrounded by art. Formal criticism, or the function of a professional, quote unquote, critic, was really just a matter of just like contingency, necessity. So I spent a good amount of my young adulthood in politics. But after I had that experience, I knew I want to go back to New York after having spent a stint in D.C., I want to go back to New York and I want to write. And right off the bat, this was, first of all, the moment of like, there were still like lots of great blogs like The All and other places still operating. But it just seemed to me by looking around that the best places to do work were like the easiest way to get published somewhere was to do criticism. So a small neighborhood paper in Brooklyn that it still is published, I think, although I'm not sure if it's in print anymore, the Brooklyn paper. I knew a guy there who was the arts editor. And I asked, I started doing these short 400 word pieces of theater criticism. And I worked up from there. I got this column at McSweeney's that was a sort of a humorous, but also critical thing. The first piece that I ever wrote for The All, RIP, was a review of a career retrospective at Brooklyn Museum of Kehinde Wiley, the painter. So just my attempt to get it, you know, to eventually realize the thing of working as a writer. Criticism was something that I realized pretty quickly I could do in a way that satisfied me, that I could illuminate things in texts and all this, but also a way to embark on the longer journey of being a writer. At this point, when I started doing this, I was very soon, like I was about to embark on writing my novel, Great Expectations. But so my work as a critic, my work in journalism grew as an almost a kind of a twin in concurrence with this other sort of endeavor in fiction. It's always been a part of the project of being a writer. But to me, a basic one, like it is basic to my way of thinking criticism. And it's lucky for me that it was a way that I could also start a practical career.
Yeah. Yeah. So you say that it was contingency or almost accident that you ended up professionally within the world of criticism, though it's central to your way of thinking about the world and thinking about art. But now, in addition to the occasion for our conversation today, the publication of your first novel, you've embarked on another new form this year, which is your podcast thing. And in this podcast, it's called Critics at Large, and it features two of your colleagues at The New Yorker, and it's critics thinking about criticism, practicing and thinking about criticism.
That's right.
I'm wondering, first of all, what has it been like working within that new form? And also if that self-reflective experience of thinking with other critics about what it is we do as critics has changed how you think about it and practice criticism.
Well, the biggest change, to maybe take the latter half of the question first, is that writing in my life, and therefore criticism in my life, has often been, rightly, I think, mostly a solitary activity.
Yeah.
Of course, other people get involved at other stages. I have close relationships with my editors. Both of my main editors at The New Yorker are dear friends of mine. I like them a lot. I'm always happy to reach the stage where we're working together. But there's a lot before that that just happens inside of me. So it is nice to have a way of doing this work, of putting texts before readers, listeners, in a generative, fruitful, critical way that is also mostly convivial and done in community. Although I will say you still have to read the stuff, watch the stuff by yourself, form critical judgments. You just don't have to do the hardest thing, which is write about them alone. So that's something that's totally different. But what's great about it, I think, is that the way we approach the show usually is, as you say, sometimes we have an episode that is about criticism. So sometimes we do think about criticism, but often we're putting texts into, it's maybe my favorite form of criticism. There are many forms. There's one thing where you just pay attention to one item and you scrape it for all its possible meanings. And that's not really what we do on the show.
Yeah.
What we do instead is another wonderful, I think, classic form of criticism, which is bringing different texts into congregation and into conversation with one another, threading connections between different texts and asking one big question. In some way, the podcast is structured like an essay. It's like, we're starting here, we're opening our aperture, and then we're asking a big question about art and the way we live now. And so it's nice to realize that's something that can be an edifice that can be built as a product of thinking together, which I really like.
So you wrote your first piece for The New Yorker, I think in 2015.
That's right.
You became a staff writer shortly thereafter. Since 2019, you've been writing primarily, although not exclusively, on theater, but you've written about the New York City public school system. You've written about a lot about the NBA as a Celtics fan. happy to read your 2022 piece about the Nets losing to the Celtics.
That's right. I'm so jealous of you right now. You've got, your team is unbelievable. Oh, man.
Yeah. But you are interested in and write on a range of different issues. And I'm wondering how those kinds of pieces, so the piece about the NBA, a piece about Afro-pessimism, sit in conjunction to the more properly critical writing. And obviously, I think you could probably answer that question differently based upon each piece. So to give it a little bit more particularity, like what differentiates the headspace you're in and the experience of writing on, say, LeBron James versus writing on, say, a new play by Will Arbery?
Yeah. Well, the NBA, well, let's say basketball makes this to me such an, for me, it's such a natural correspondence because it's got movement. It's got moments of aesthetic illumination. It's also got story. It's got, there's so much that happens in sports that to me, it's like writing about dance. Sometimes before I write a basketball piece, I'll read one of my colleagues, the recently departed Joan Acocello, one of my favorite critics, reading her dance pieces helped me figure out how I wanted to talk about basketball players. The link in all of these things, whether, as you mentioned, I'm talking about politics, personal history, sports, and then the proper topic of the arts, is attention. The idea that attention and description will yield insights if you take them seriously, if you buckle down and figure out how to see and then how to report. There's something to be learned in that material. And when I say see, I mean see and hear and smell and taste and feel. That attention to phenomena outside of yourself and then attention to their effect on you, their interior fruits, right? That this always has dividends. This will always yield something. Mm-hmm. That promise is something that I hold on to as a kind of faith. And I think that is the connective tissue for me that makes all of my work on some level capital C critical.
We'll have more of Tony's conversation with Vincent Cunningham in a minute.
I'm Claudia Avila Cosnahan, Director of Mission and Partnerships at Commonweal. One thing I love about Commonweal is our spirit of curiosity. It shapes everything we do, from religion to politics to culture and the arts. Consider becoming a Commonweal associate today. Just visit commonwealmagazine.org/donate. Your gift helps support everything we do, including this podcast. Now let's get back to the conversation.
On the podcast, you're talking about what constitutes criticism. And you said something like the critic has to be someone who loves experience and who wants to extend and amplify experience through attention.
Yeah. Right?
And I'm wondering how you think about how you experience that love of experience as a critic, what the inner fruits of that experience are in comparison to the kind of love of experience that you have as a novelist, right? In other words, are there different kinds of attention that you're paying as a critic versus to experience versus the kinds of attention you're paying as a novelist?
It's such a great question. And it gets right at the heart of perhaps what I think is a sometimes totally immaterial boundary between these and many other functions of the writer, right? Because for me, one way to define fiction is as critique of reality, the criticism of life, or the criticism of society or of manners. And so sometimes you might say that fiction is a way of performing critique on things that are not, this is such a rough sketch because, of course, fiction can also hold works of art. A guy in a novel can go watch a show and tell you what he sees. And all of a sudden he's doing criticism and is also an act of fiction. That's a lot of the method of this novel. And that might just come down to that being the primary mode in which I live my life. But maybe the focus, the ambit of the criticism of the novel is more about society and more about interpersonal, how we live together. And the locus of criticism is, of course, works of art. But of course, the only way to do real criticism that matters at all is to acknowledge art as a product of those manners that live inside the novel, that they're all rushing at us from the same source. So there's a kind of continuum. Because if you live in the world, you will see people and you will see their clothes and you will see their sort of class performances and their sexualities and all these other things. But you will also encounter works of art. These are all phenomena that happen to us in the narratives of our lives, and therefore they're not so easily picked apart one from the other. If you write a theater review, sometimes if you just imagine a sentence at the beginning that's, I walked to the theater, and at the end of the piece say, and then I went home, and you're on your way to writing fiction. The way you looked, the way you experienced, the way you saw becomes part of a narrative, and therefore the critical act becomes storied, let's say, that these things are right around the corner from one another.
Yeah, I think that comes across again and again in Great Expectations, which actually opens with a kind of act of criticism, right? With the narrator listening to a speech and responding critically to it. But I wonder if you could just talk us through a little bit about its origins.
Sure.
You mentioned that you have been working on it for a while. It's in, I think, obvious and deep ways. Arises in part from your own experience working on Obama's campaign. Just talk a little bit about how it came to be and in particular, why this story seemed to require the novel as a form as opposed to, say, an essay.
One day I was going to a friend's house and the party was on the Upper East Side and I had walked from my mom's apartment on the Upper West Side and I stopped at the edge of the park right on Fifth Avenue, and looked up at the building where this party was going to happen. And it struck me that down to the class of the people throwing the party and the kinds of people that would be at the party, how I was dressed for the party, that my attendance there, my sort of implicit belonging there, was the result of a kind of travel in my life. Mm. That things had happened, events had stacked them up in such a way that I had now come into acquaintance with a different kind of person. You know what I mean? And I wanted to, number one, I wanted to write about parties as the vehicles and also the results of that kind of travel through society, through life. So the first version of this book, which I spent 3 years on and then threw away all but one page, was The Logic. And I wasn't sure if I was going to totally, maybe the Obama campaign or something like an Obama campaign would be somewhere in the background, but I wasn't sure how foregrounded it would be. But this long gone novel happened only at parties. But the one part of it that felt true to me was a page in which the narrator of the story has stopped in someone's bedroom to look at a Renoir painting. Mm. And he describes it and draws correspondences after he reaches into it and the history of his taste and all of this, then responds to it almost biographically and starts to make correspondences between the painting and things that have happened in his life. And I said, that's the kind of narrator that this is. So this happened in like 2016, right as I was starting at The New Yorker. And so from then until 2021, when I finished the first draft of this book, fun fact, I finished this book on January 6th. So it was a weird way of, I guess, my body telling me that I had, again, completed some kind of cycle or whatever. That was the span of the making of this novel. And number one, I always knew that I wanted to write a novel. It is one of my favorite forms and my favorite ways to encounter reality. And one of the things that I think the novel does well, I've actually been reading a lot of Christopher Isherwood recently. I'm reading Down There on a Visit right now. Mm-hmm. But what he does consistently so well is in telling story, in starting from the heart of a sort of sensitive narrator who can go out into the world, is able to organize histories, to talk about the rise of the Nazis, for example, or talk about pan-European travel as a sort of expatriate Londoner. Tell us about a type that exists. And it seemed to me that this moment in American history, 07 and 08, this time of really ecstatic hopes and all these things. Number one, I wanted things to happen that did not happen. So that's part of it. And there's lots of this happened in this story that didn't happen in a way that does another one of the classic things of the novel is not only to historicize, but then to moralize history, right? To place a moral layer over what has happened. And so to me, it always was a novel. It was never even a question. If I wrote an essay about me and the Obama campaign, it would be the most boring thing in the world. It would not be good.
Well, so it's interesting, right? Because it, in obvious ways, politics is the engine of the novel, right? Kind of David, almost by accident, wanders into Obama's campaign, right? Campaign of the senator from Illinois, right? As he's called in the novel. In addition to being a political novel, it is a novel of sentimental education, right? And it's also a deeply religious novel. It's a novel that has beautiful passages of theological speculation. And David is a character who, at one point, he says something like, well, he says, I could understand many ways of thinking without committing to anything in particular. I admired surrender. Phenomena floated past me. And one of the things that he sometimes surrenders to and sometimes resists is God, right? And the wonderful passage about David learning about the sacramental imagination from a Jesuit principal, mm-hmm. who uses Gerard Manley Hopkins as a way to think about not just the sacrament as in the Eucharist, but seeing the world as sacrament.
That's right.
And I was struck and I was thinking that the novel has, of course, often been understood as a specifically secular form that kind of arises with, and it's not a coincidence that it arises with secularism. And I'm wondering generally how you think about the relationship between religion and the novel. And it's a big question.
Well, it's such a rich question. I think that the novel is an undogmatic form. Mm. That life in its movements and fits and starts and surprises and cataclysms conforms to no doctrine, can be pulled through no one or other sort of particular formula. The novel is not the sermon. There are didactic novels, but most of us agree that they are not good.
Yeah.
Again, a certain kind of religious literature won't make that jump. Tomasa Kempis does not make it across that. I love The Imitation of Christ. There's no line from that to the novel as we understand it. But of course, there is a line from the confessions to the novel, that a true accounting of the soul's squirming under God's microscope as it becomes clearer and clearer, whatever that is, there's a line between that and Flannery O'Connor's Wise Blood, right? There's a line between that and, well, first of all, the essays of Montaigne or whatever, right? The sort of the psychology that happens in Montaigne that I think is also antecedent to the novel as I understand it. But the sort of the text, the psychological texture of life trying to achieve an ideal, trying to culminate a great love, however we figure religion to be, that to me all fits within the sort of ambit of the novel. But of course, if you have any kind of religious mindset, this took, for me, was a big question, because I knew that I wanted this guy to believe in God, which even though he goes back and forth in his attitude toward God, I think David Hammond believes in God. But if you're a novelist, you also get to decide whether God exists in your novel. You know what I mean? But that's something that blows my mind. It's if I'm creating a world, I could decide whether God acts in this world or not, or whether God reveals God's self in this text or not. I love the line from the mother in Raisin in the Sun, the daughter sliding into secularism. She's much more interested in art, the world of intellect or whatever. Beneatha, she's not about it. And the mother says, in my mother's house, she makes her repeat after, in my mother's house, there is God. And I kept hearing that, like, in this novel, there is God. I could decide that. And so the moment you set yourself up as creator, I think there is some kind of religious question. If you write, if you're writing, anytime you ask, you assert yourself into a narrative, question of fate has to come up. The question of determinism has to factor in. So I think narrative is a deeply theological act.
Your novel is the right kind of religious novel, right? That it's an Augustinian novel. It's about memory. It's about sensuousness. And it's novel that I'm certain our listeners will enjoy reading. And thank you, Vincent, for being here and talking with me about it today.
Oh, this has been such a pleasure. I cannot thank you enough.
Vincent Cunningham's new novel, entitled Great Expectations, is available from Hogarth Books. For the Commonweal Podcast, this is Dominic Preziosi. The Commonweal Podcast is produced by Associate Editor Griffin Olenek and the Commonweal staff, in partnership with Sandberg Media. Wally Boudway composed the music, and David Dalt did the editing. If you like what you heard, please rate and review the show on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. And please share it with friends, family, and anyone else who enjoys thoughtful, in-depth conversations like the ones we have here. I'm Dominic Preziosi for the Commonweal Podcast.